Welcome to the Recovery.com podcast. Join us as we navigate the nuances of recovery, featuring heartfelt stories, expert insights, and the latest breakthroughs in mental health and healing. Whether you're taking the first step or continuing your recovery journey, we're here and hope to support, inform, and inspire you. I'm your host, Senior Director of Content at Recovery.com, Dr. Mala Choudhury-Malgeri. And today, I'm joined by fellow host and Chief Growth Officer at Recovery.com, Cliff McDonald. I'm so excited to welcome today Amanda Upoff, powerhouse of a woman and beautiful heart. I'm so excited. Welcome, Amanda.
Thanks, Mala. I'm super excited to be talking with you and Cliff today.
So I wanted to just jump right in and have you share a little bit about your experiences in your life and how you believe they shaped your journey to date.
Sure. So I grew up in Akron, Ohio, really loving family. I'm the oldest of three, the only girl. From a really young age, as young as five, I remember feeling responsible for other people's happiness, especially my youngest brother, and just a deep need to excel at everything I did. Some very strong people pleaser tendencies from a young age, and was a straight A student, played a few instruments, model child, typical oldest child stuff. Yeah. Probably starting about the eighth grade, I started to have a kind of unhealthy relationship with food. So I'd been an overweight child. And right around middle school is when it became really apparent to me that that was maybe not such a great thing to be. So went on a pretty strict diet. I wouldn't say I was flirting with an eating disorder, but hadn't developed it yet. It wasn't until I went off to college. So pretty unhealthy relationship with food through high school, but really, show me any teenage girl who doesn't have kind of a strange relationship with food. Yeah, went to college, fell into it. Nobody was watching what I ate. And so I was also dancing at the time in college and received really positive feedback for my weight loss. Yeah, the sicker I got, sort of the better things got for me. Lots of attention from men, boys really at that age, but just sort of an interesting thing to happen. So that's a positive reinforcement.
Right, right. So that external validation that you received paradoxically made life seem better. So how did you navigate that? And, how did that feedback influence your continued perception, especially during an era of our lives, like that 18-year-old, 20 to 25-year-old period when we're just like coming out, and that's that emerging adulthood period. Oh my gosh. So prime. Yeah.
Right. And I'll say life got better for a minute. Like addictions and eating disorders work for a long time, but then they stop working. So when I really got sick, I went home for Christmas and my parents said, you're not going back unless you get some weight. And I saw pictures of myself and was never so sick that I couldn't see in a picture that I was not okay. That's actually, I recommend that technique a lot. I'm sure you've used it or know of it. It's funny how you can't see in the mirror, but if you see a picture, it lands better. So yeah, loving family, made sure I got some help. I say my anorexia was really my first addiction. It numbed out feelings, and saw a lot of the same tropes happening with my alcohol addiction, like using external behaviors and controls to navigate and alter my interior landscape.
What was that landscape that you were trying to alter? Like, what did you specifically?
So insecurity, self-loathing, never enoughness, fear, uncertainty, any discomfort, really anything less than great needed to go.
So what triggered the shift then you started to get help. Your family was supporting you. How would you describe the shift? Was there a shift? Did it happen immediately? You know, did it resonate with you? Did you stick with it? What did it look like?
The shift, I was able to get well. I do think that anorexia lay dormant in my brain for a long time and, you know, still comes out sometimes, to be honest. But restoring weight helps restore that brain function that is really necessary to start to get well.
I was just going to say, Amanda, this is, first of all, it's great to be here with you. I know a little bit about you already, and I find you to be a very inspiring teammate. So this is a real privilege to be here with you. And I'm learning a lot already. So you recovered early from something, right? This is the recovery.com podcast. Amanda, you said you got help. What did that help look like then? I'm guessing this is late 90s, right? We're battling stigma, right? You come from, I think, a successful, respected family. You were a great student. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear more about that. Was it, don't tell anyone? Was it outpatient? Was it therapy? Was it residential?
Yeah, it was 94 and it was therapy. It was just individual therapy. And because it was so important to me to be able to keep living my life. I mean, I was in college. I was loving college. I was loving this dance troupe I was with. I didn't want all that to go away. So I kind of took my medicine, which was eat food and go to therapy. Looking back, I mean, I don't know if that was a strong recovery. It worked and it got me through. And then, you know, later in life, my pregnancies, I think both of them healed that relationship with my body. I mean, boy, pregnancy will teach you the power of your body. It's hard to hate something that does something so magical. So yes, to answer your question, it was just individual therapy at that time a real strong desire to not lose what I had.
Yes. So the recovery there was, first of all, you acknowledged, right? In a 12 step, right? Admitted. So the pictures, were the pictures the trigger that you said, okay, yeah. And your parents, it sounded like very loving. So you raised your hand and said, yeah, I've got something here, which is, I think, really impressive from a 20-something, very young adult. And then it sounds like the therapy was very effective too. Do you remember like breakthroughs that occurred there? Or was it more, I want to get back to this life that is rich with this dance group. And if I don't fix this, I won't have that. Is that more what it was?
Far more.
Okay.
Like 99%
the latter.
So I've been described by some therapists I've had in a, I hope, loving way as being somewhat therapy resistant because I am so run on self-will. I really am, like, nobody knows me more than me. And it's not the greatest. But no, the therapy really didn't do much. It was a box I checked at that time.
And I want to go to college. I want to be a part of this dance group. Therefore, I will eat and I will gain 8 pounds so I can get back to the life that I want.
Yeah. And I think being so young really did help me there because, you know, at that age, we're used to doing what people tell us to do. If you do X, you get Y.
Sure.
Do you know?
Yeah, you were
as
comfortable.
Yeah. That's a harder.
Yeah. Absolutely.
When you were checking off the boxes and, you know, like in the throes of your group, experiencing what you were you able to utilize that even then? I know you have a passion for helping people around you and helping the next woman behind you, as you like to say. Did you find yourself kind of leaning into that at that time?
No, that is only something I've experienced with my alcohol use disorder and the recovery community in that regard. Boy, not to... all addiction is hard, but I think there are certain characteristics of an eating disorder that don't lend itself maybe to that. There's the comparison, the like it's an icky competition. I mean, there are years where I couldn't be in the room if there was someone smaller than me in the room. Do you know? Like it was just not okay. So it's harder. I find it far easier to help women who are trying to stop drinking or using.
So at that time, when you were in the dance troupe and in college and going through college, was your healing happening privately more so than with the support of your peers?
Totally. Mm-hmm. I mean, eating disorder, you wear your struggles on your body. So people see what's happening. It's much harder to keep it a secret. So I'm sure people knew something was happening, but no, I was very secret about it and didn't talk about it.
Curious, how did that influence how you connected with your peers? And it's very common during that time, of course, to want to engage in what we call risk-taking behaviors and just going out there. And those risks are anything from, I'm going to try a new course out, to I'm going to switch professions or majors, to I'm going to go out and I'm going to drink when I'm going to take the dares. So how did going through this influence your perception towards those types of risks and the common risk-taking behaviors that people in that age definitely engage in?
Yeah, so I'm a very late bloomer when it comes to drinking. Even in college, I mean, well, don't forget alcohol has calories. So that was not really going to happen for me. And also, I got pretty intoxicated on a really small amount. So I never was like a let's go crazy kind of gal. Plus, I was in this rigorous performance troupe and didn't really go to parties. And it's funny, right? Given what happened later in my life. And I actually do think, so just to kind of fast forward, I think that being so buttoned up for so much of my early life really led to my mid-30s kind of having like the adolescence I never had. And that's when I went a little crazy, my friend. That's when I was in clubs and I was drinking too much and I was doing some reckless stuff is when I was 36 years old.
So, you know, changes in life, of course, that leads to what you're describing right now. What were you experiencing? Was there something stressful? Was it, you know, were there challenges specifically that shifted you from, nope, I'm not drinking to all of a sudden this is an option?
Yeah. And I really do like to highlight this story because it's not special. Like I'm not unique. This is a common story I've heard from a lot of women is I had my babies. I was a great mom for the first few years of their lives. Really invested a lot of time into my family and making sure everyone was happy and healthy. And I opened a yoga studio. So I opened a small business when my youngest was 2.5. So I had a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old and a small business. And I say that some people are constitutionally built for small business ownership, and I am not one of those people because I wasn't able to just leave things. So just had to respond to all the emails before I went to bed, and which is a joke. There's never any end to the emails. So I was getting like 3 hours of sleep, really sleep deprived, fell back into my eating disorder. So had a relapse of that kind of accidentally, like just with the sleep deprivation and teaching so much yoga, I just started to lose weight. And then I liked it because I'm an anorexic. So all of that to say is my brain was not functioning. And at that same time, I was introduced to wine for the first time. And I loved it. I loved it a lot. It really smoothed the edges and made everything just a little bit better. And it felt glamorous to me and sophisticated. Because of my yoga studio, I was sort of, I like to say, I felt like one of the cool kids for the first time in my life. I mean, women who I respected and admired in the Madison small business community were inviting me to go to lunch. And there were news pieces. I mean, I was on the news and I was in magazine articles and there were photo shoots and video shoots. And I just felt it was very intoxicating in every sense of the word. So yeah, I fell all the way in love with wine. And it was great until it really wasn't.
Amanda, so you were a new drinker, really? at what, 33, 35, kind of? Like, have you ever had more than 36. Two drinks before then? But like, had you ever been drunk before then?
Nope.
Really?
I would say I had been drunk, I mean, off of like 1.5 light beers.
Okay, that's not
but
drunk
yeah,
in my
then
book,
I discovered
but,
wine.
Yeah. Okay, and then so 33, 35, you discover wine and your honesty is admirable with this thing that I'm doing isn't what someone who abuses alcohol would do. I'm drinking wine and sophisticated and I'm a business owner. And we know that the disease is a progressive disease. You've shared several things that indicate you've got an obsessiveness to your work, right? An obsessiveness to answering every email and being perfect and all of these things. In the 12 steps, we talk about recovery being removing the obsession, right? By working the 12 steps. Talk about the progression of your disease with how quickly or slowly it went from I'm having a glass of wine to really drinking in a very unhealthy way. Was it slow? Was it fast? I'd love to hear about this progression.
I would say it was neither slow nor fast, but I think it was quicker. I would say it took about 1.5 years before I was drinking by myself, just a glass or two, which again, wasn't like scary to me. It was after about another year that it was for sure at least a bottle a night. And then another year, it was at least 2 a night. And then it was, I don't know how many, but I didn't care if I woke up in the morning kind of thing. Once it got to a bottle a night, me drinking by myself, it was really, really pretty quick. Yeah.
Do you remember, because you know, I hang around with a lot of alcoholics in recovery and they share their stories freely. Do you distinctly remember a moment or two when you're like, this is wrong? I shouldn't be doing this. I remember several.
Yeah,
of those,
for
like,
sure.
I was buying it at the wrong time and I had to start like juggling the stores that I would go to. And I would start making up this excuse like, oh, I'm going to stop by here or and just these things that I had never done before. Right. And kind of knowing that's when the madness started. Right. Like. And that's when I became a dishonest person too, right? Lying to myself and others. Do you have distinct memories of those like things when it changed?
Well, the thing that got me was when I realized it was becoming a problem and I told myself, I'm going to stop. And then I couldn't stop. And you guys, I was anorexic. Like, how could I not stop consuming something? That's what I did. Like, that was my jam. How is this not? How can I not control this? And so it got into this rut, this pattern cliff of every night, I would say, tonight is the last night. And every day by 5 o'clock, I was buying more. I couldn't even get a day. So I am, obsessive. I'm the real deal.
So it's always interesting, and we're all multifaceted, right? And it's always complex. So you're sharing that you were able to say, I'm not eating for a day, for days, and really control that. But this substance was different, and you couldn't control that. That must have been really interesting. You just shared that, like, why can I do this but not this?
It was terrifying. Yeah. So then I did seek out treatment and I was able to, that's its whole journey, trying to find treatment for yourself when you are distinctly unwell and not even really sure you want it in the first place. So it requires a lot of phone call, a lot of work. I mean, it's like a full-time job to do something you're not even sure you really want to do. So but I did eventually get into treatment, a residential program. It was fine. I remember the first day there kind of looking around and being like, oh, this isn't the magic bullet that I want it to be. I'm still here, you know, because you hold out hope for that thing that's going to make it, that's going to fix it.
Yeah, and the panacea.
Yeah, residential treatment was,
right.
Right. Yeah. I'm here.
I'm here.
I'm not fixed.
Why aren't things, isn't it magically better right now? Yeah.
Very.
Right. And that ultimately wasn't the right program for me for a number of reasons, but I didn't even really know what that time that there that programs mm-hmm. were different. I think a lot of people still don't. That's why our work here is so important to me, because that can make all the difference in the world. So, stayed pretty sick after that for a while, but then got myself to treatment again. And 2 years later, this program was much better for me. There was a really beautiful spiritual advisor at this second program. And with my deep love of yoga and spiritual practices, it really spoke to me. That was also in California. So I got to kind of, the first program I did was in Wisconsin. It's interesting. A lot of people want to stay close to home for treatment because their family can visit them and XYZ. But I'm kind of an advocate for the opposite, like just going away, taking care of yourself. Don't worry about the kids coming to visit on Sunday, because then if you're like me, you're going to have to put on your makeup and pretend like mommy's okay. And what if mommy's not okay? Like maybe mommy should go somewhere for 30 to 60 days and just like really unravel so that she can be put back together again in a more helpful way. I think so many women struggle with this, like need to keep it together. And like, there's a crack. Okay, quick, fill the crack. But with even if it's a little filled, it's still there. And then the cracks really add up. And anyway, I'm a big fan of just taking all the time for yourself. And sometimes that means going away. So, okay, I'm fast forwarding treatment in California in 2018. I say I've been mostly sober since then. I was a chronic relapser, but my last relapse was on January 13th, 2020. Everyone's like, oh, right before the pandemic, was the pandemic hard? The pandemic was a blessing. It was a gift, because one of the hardest consequences of my drinking was the damage that I did to my relationships with my children, specifically my daughter. She's also the oldest child, daughter. And boy, she saw through me. She could tell when I was drunk when nobody else could tell. Mm-hmm. So she sees into my soul, that one. And had a lot of work to do to repair that relationship. And the pandemic gave us that gift of being stuck together in a house for months and going on those family walks every evening and her seeing me do the work. So after that last relapse, I did everything that women I respected told me to do. So I got a sponsor. I worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a mentor from the clinic that I did a step down IOP program with. And then I became a mentor. And when everything shut down and went virtual, I hosted a virtual support group. I taught virtual yoga, all for my recovery community. And she saw me doing all this. And I wasn't doing it, you know, performatively or so that people would notice. It was just, we were stuck in a house, so there was no hiding. I was going to my therapy virtually. So yeah, it kind of fast forward the healing process in a really beautiful way. So I'm super grateful for COVID.
You mentioned before also that you were facing the prospect of losing custody at one point. That must have been incredibly difficult. How did that impact your view of addiction and your motivation to seek help?
That was a really tough experience. I don't fault my ex-husband because I was not well, and I would have done the same thing if I were him. But that process, it's broken, and I don't know how to fix it, because the reason behind the process makes sense. So you have a person who's in addiction, who's in active addiction. So the courts want you to have a social worker. They want you to have a guardian ad litem in place. There are supervised visits. This is a terrifying process. The one thing that I always thought was true was that I would have the love of my children and the physical presence of my children. So you're yanking that rug out from underneath me. And again, like, it's not wrong that they do this. Like, it might not be safe for these children. We have to keep them safe. But this whole process is so terrifying. And there's so many steps that need to be taken and appointments. And meanwhile, I'm trying to hold down a full-time job and I'm trying to not drink. I mean, and drinking is the one thing that helps me get through hard times. And now the times are the hardest they've ever been. It's just not a recipe for success. And I don't have the solutions, but it's something I do like to talk about with women who are experiencing this because it is terrifying. So just having someone who's walked it before who maybe can give you some tips. There's some very real prejudice against addicts and alcoholics. And it's not all wrong. I mean, we are liars and for sure want to stay. Anyway, I experienced that quite a bit. And that is hurtful. It's even more terrifying because I could be doing all the right things, but they're just sitting there waiting for me to fail. They're just waiting for me to mess up. And then when I do, it's like, well, I knew it. I also like to say that for many years of my life, I was cast in the role of train wreck. And I played that role really well because, you know, everyone was convinced and they had me convinced too.
This is a tricky one, Amanda. You know, like, I have three boys and the love I have for my children is like nothing I've ever experienced. And yet still, I personally think the love a mother has for her children is different. I don't know if it's stronger, but it's different. And I've witnessed that. And when I was early in recovery, a very good friend of mine who was in recovery, he said, you're going to lose anything you put in front of your recovery. And we see so often parents that are struggling with substance use disorder that don't get the level of care that they need because of their children. I can't go away. I have to be near my children. I can't go to meeting tonight. I have to be there for my children, right? And it, Dr. Molly, you talk about the paradoxes, right? Like, and it really is so true. People that put their job in front of their recovery, I can't go away because of my work or whatever it might be. I'm just so happy for you that where you are today, it's almost hard to believe that you were in a position not that long ago, right? Like, it's amazing that, you know, I would say 2018, 6 years is when the lights kind of came on and you started living differently. But then, you know, 4 years, 2 months, it's really inspiring, right? That you were in a position where you might not have a relationship with your children. Like, that's really hard for me to believe hearing that. And I know you pretty well.
Thank you. And thank you for saying that about women needing to, it is hard to put yourself above your kids, but that's what I had to do. And that is what I did, actually. That's when I went to California. And I was in California for Mother's Day. I mean, I remember sitting in church on Mother's Day and just weeping, like, what happened? Like, kind of looking around. Yeah, you have to heal yourself before you get all the joys of recovery. And, you know, we give up that one thing, drinking, and we get all the other things. So it is amazing, too, when you work a strong program, how quickly the miracles do happen. But I had to surrender and I had to get to that point where I accepted, like, a deep acceptance and peace that nothing is guaranteed in terms of my relationship with my children, with financial or career success. Like, none of that is guaranteed. And I just had to be content and dedicated to waking up every day and being the best version of me that I could be and doing good work in the world. And then whatever else happens, great. But not attaching to any specific outcome. That's a Buddhist principle that I really try to live my life by. Yeah, you can't squeeze that butterfly in your hand. You just, I mean, you just, because we never know.
Yeah, attachment and everything is impermanent. Those things are really powerful. It's also amazing, too. We have a lot of similarities, right? Like, there's no way I can go away. There's no way I can be away from my children. And I had a habit for 35 years. And I thought 30 days was a ridiculous amount of time, right? And one thing we know is that the only correlation with outcomes that we've seen for substance use disorder is length of time in treatment. The longer you have, the greater the odds that the outcome is going. That's a massive rewiring project. And for you, your drinking wasn't until mid-30s, but the obsessive behaviors were much earlier. Any thoughts on how we could convince the sick person that, like, taking some time here in the near term will give you a whole life, right? Because we always see so much resistance. And Amanda, I also, it's amazing that you raised your own hand and you were picking up the phone in this care navigation challenge, right, that we're trying to fix. You don't see that too much. So you had these kind of, I think, like mini lights coming on events where you knew you weren't well. But any thoughts, Amanda, like how can we get through to the person still suffering that you got to take some time? That's one of the hardest challenges, isn't it?
It is. I've mentored women who don't want to go to treatment because of their dogs. I mean, they can't leave their dogs. Their life is in a shambles, but they can't leave the animals for 30 days. And Cliff, I think treatment is different. People require different kinds of treatment. I don't think 60 or 90 days in residential treatment would have prevented me from relapsing again. Because I can be a star student when people mm-hmm. are watching. That's kind mm-hmm. of my MO. It's like the anorexic. They handed me that mm-hmm. manual, do you know? It's what happens when I leave treatment and nobody is watching that it gets really dangerous for me. So I had to figure out how to live life and do the right thing even when nobody was watching, until I believed that it really was the right thing, really was staying sober, do you know? I mean, it wasn't like a treat to get to drink. It was the thing that was going to ruin my life. I don't know how to convince people to put their lives on pause. I think that like any decision that's big, they have to want it.
Sure.
You have to be ready to put it above everything
else.
I was going to ask about when you leave treatment, right? It's a very, very dangerous time and right, high risk. We're seeing a huge improvement in extended care mm-hmm. programs where you might go residential, then a step down, sober living or IOP. Did you have an effective aftercare program looking back, or did you just go back to your regular world and everything was okay?
Yeah, so I did. The second time I did, and I highly recommend that step down, but I still had to fly home from California, and you can guess what I did on the plane mm-hmm. on the way home from treatment. But once I got back, and that was my only relapse, because then I went into IOP, rocked IOP. They had a mentorship program, got a mentor, started that whole thing. I did still have one relapse left in me. Yeah, so big believer in the step down approach, and any support you can get and any wellness practice you can engage in. So physical movement is really important to my sobriety. Connecting with other women in recovery is important to my recovery. Service work is really important to my recovery. Nature is really important. I mean, there are so many things that aren't your traditional pathways mm-hmm. to recovery that I employ in mine. And it's just like, I just cobbled together a really beautiful basket mm-hmm. of recovery. And that basket is full of different things for different people. And I encourage women to just keep on grabbing stuff and sticking it in your basket, because that might be the thing.
Yep, that's
you know?
What we like to talk about is toolboxes and creating those toolboxes or baskets. I think you put it perfectly. I think, you know, one question that I have also is challenges and victories, right? Like, did the challenges and victories that you encountered in residential and or outpatient fuel the understanding of what you were going to need in that basket? And how did you get there? What did that look like?
It became really apparent to me that honesty is probably the most important part of my recovery. So I should have probably mentioned that earlier, but rigorous mm-hmm. honesty, the piece that was missing, and it was like this golden key that once I realized it and put it in the lock, everything changed, because I had been doing all that other, most of mm-hmm. that other stuff mm-hmm. in the basket and with pretty good success, but it wasn't, I didn't feel free from the obsession the way that I did once honesty became, you know, the altar at which I pray. It really So I say rigorous honesty and aggressive authenticity are my two main principles to my recovery. Yeah. And I mean, that's about everything. I can't lie about anything because that is a snowball. And next thing you know, I'm lying about whether or not I'm drinking. I don't know. I hope never to come to that. But no lie needs to have a place in my life.
I love it. You've talked about also medication-assisted treatment and how that plays a role in recovery. I think a lot of stigma surrounds that, and a lot of people have fear around engaging in it. Can you share your experiences with that and what how that looks in your life?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. So I take something called Antabuse. It is a pill that stays in your body for 7 to 10 days, I think. And when it reacts with alcohol, you become violently ill. So I do have to carry a card in my wallet because there are some medications that I can't have as I'm taking Antabuse. And I think I've been in meetings where people think maybe it's not a true recovery because I do have this crutch. And for a long time, I also thought that. I thought I shouldn't need this. And the truth is, I don't know if I need it anymore. But every time in the past I've decided to stop it, I can trace it back. That was my addict mind telling me, preparing myself for a relapse. So I'm not of childbearing age anymore. I'm never going to be pregnant again. There's no harm for me taking this pill. There's no long-term health risk from taking it. I've talked to my doctors about it extensively. So why not have that seventh or eighth safety net underneath me? So if and when I ever fall, it's there to catch me. And the people I've talked to about it who are resistant in women who are trying to get sober, it's funny the things that they are resistant to. They're resistant ultimately because they know they're not going to stop drinking and they don't want to get sick.
There's like that perception where if you take it, it's a crutch. But if you're not taking it, what's not realized, I think, is that if you're not taking it, you're saying, I don't actually want to experience the symptoms of it. So I think that's a stigma that 100% needs to be broken. And, you know, the mechanics of it from an emotional and drive perspective need to be understood for sure.
Yeah, and it's not a perfect solution. I don't think it would be a great first safety net because it is a pill that you have to take in order for it to work. And you can still drink on it. I mean, I tried it a few times and let me tell you, it's rough. So it's not perfect, but it's a safety net.
I think it's a great example of an individual recovery plan, right? Everyone's recovery is different in that historically, that has not been the case. It's been, oh, you have to do this program and you have to stand this way and walk this way and speak this way. Amanda, you figured out something that works for you, which is wonderful. And you're flourishing and you're thriving. I know there is criticism of this, right? They would say it's forced sobriety, right? And the only reason I'm not drinking is because there's this threat, right? I still want to drink, but if I do, I'll get sick. People would say that that isn't the healthiest approach, right? But at the end of the day, it's like, who cares? This is working. And I think it's also like a harm reduction discussion a little bit. I think it's absolutely fantastic. I'm sponsoring a guy who's taking Antabuse. And we just brought this up and he said, someone told me that that's like something I shouldn't be doing.
There it is.
And what the person told him was, you're cheating. And I coached him up a little bit and with this, this is my recovery that's working today. And I haven't drank in quite some time. I personally feel a level of safety and comfort knowing that if I did happen to drink, if I lost my ability to make a good decision for a tiny little moment, I'm going to get really sick. And that's enough to render me not going to drink, and it's working. So I'm really glad we talked about that because it's working, right? And that's your
program. Me too. Yeah, and like I said, I don't know if it's a great first safety net. I don't think it's enough on its own to be a recovery program. But someone like your sponsee is working the steps, working the program.
Right.
That's not cheating. He's working a solid program. Right. And so am I. I mean, it's like I've done all the things. The thing is, I was such a chronic relapser that all the things weren't enough to keep me sober.
Yeah.
I mean, I need even more than all the things.
Well,
I have
another guy that I'm working with who was recently incarcerated for about 4 months. And it was a brutal environment. They didn't have meetings. Mm-hmm. He couldn't work out. They didn't have a library. Mm-hmm. And this is a very highly educated.
They have no books.
This is a highly educated person.
Yeah.
And I am so proud of him. He said, I have never wanted to drink as much as when I got out of prison. Right? 120 days, white knuckling it. Talk about seeking relief. They gave him zero relief. And think about the number of people that, sorry, I'm going on a little bit of a rant here, but 70 to 80% of people who are incarcerated in this country are in there with behavioral health addiction related issues, right? The things that they did that landed them where they are were things they did when they were not of sound mind. And then they're in there without any resources.
Yeah.
So I but it's not uncommon for those people that's forced sobriety to relapse the first day they're out. What are you going to go do, man? Wow. Right? He didn't though.
That's
really
great. Yeah, that's great. For somebody who might be struggling with similar issues, you shared some great advice. What else would you offer based on your experiences and your recovery?
Community is everything. And that community can start really small. I recommend finding one person who you can be rigorously honest with, who you can tell everything. That can just be one person and then it can grow. But there are lots of great support groups everywhere, I think in every city and virtually, if you don't have one in your city, if you're in a smaller town, give back. I think service work is really important to a strong recovery program. Take care of your body, mind, and spirit. Get 8 hours of sleep, eat healthy, move your body. Doesn't have to be crazy, nothing crazy. I love yoga because it sort of multitasks for me and get a little meditation, a little physical movement. Yeah, those are things I really recommend for everyone.
What are your hopes for the future, both personally and in terms of raising awareness for everything that you talked about today, eating disorders, addiction, and more?
I don't consider myself an advocate on a large scale, but I do really like to advocate for individual women and help them on their paths. So I'm a certified recovery coach. I use a lot of those things, a lot of those skills when I mentor women and help them through their legal troubles or their trouble at work, make sure they know about their rights, make sure they know their options for treatment, help them navigate insurance stuff. So I really enjoy helping women find their path to recovery. For myself, I just pinch myself most days that I get to wake up and live this gorgeous, beautiful life that I never thought was possible. I really didn't. I mean, that acceptance, and it was real, the acceptance I came to when I surrendered and said, okay, I'll live in a tiny house and I'll ride my bike everywhere and I'll see my children at their performances and baseball games, and I'll never get to kiss them goodnight in my house. So that acceptance was real. And the miracle of recovery is that it's just so much better than I ever dreamed.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that. Last question on my end that we ask everyone, what does recovery mean to you?
Recovery is endless possibility. It's the opportunity day after day after day to know better and to do better and to be better. Yeah,
I love it.
That's it.
Thank you so much, Amanda. It's really been an honor to hear your story, and I'm thankful for everything that you shared today. And of course, it's just great to have these open conversations.
Yeah. It's so important. I'm so grateful for you too. And Cliff, thank you so much for the conversation. Appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Recovery.com podcast. For additional information, resources, and to access treatment options, please visit our website at recovery.com. We appreciate your listenership and are excited to have you join us on our next show coming soon.